We're going to be on page 24 in just a moment. Don't believe I'm going to get through the whole rest of the book, but that's why I gave it to you, so you can use it yourself. But I found this very, very interesting. Scientists recover T-Rex soft tissue. 70-million-year-old fossil yields preserved blood vessels. This is March 24th, 2005. Let me just tell you, something that's been dead for 70 million years wouldn't yield soft tissue. Reading from the Associated Press, right here, and they have pictures of the soft blood vessels. For more than a century, the study of dinosaurs has been limited to fossilized bones. Now researchers have recovered 70 million year old soft tissue, including what may be blood vessels and cells from a Tyrannosaurus Rex. Ooh. If scientists can isolate proteins from the material, they may be able to learn new details how dinosaurs lived, said the researcher from North Carolina State University. We're doing a lot of stuff in the lab now. That looks promising, she said. It was recovered dinosaur DNA, the blueprint for life, that was featured in the fictional recreation of the ancient animals in the film Jurassic Park. The soft tissues were recovered from the thigh bone of a T-Rex known as MOR 1125, that was found in a sandstone formation in Montana. The dinosaur was about 18 years old when it died and laid there for 70 million, never mind. The bone was broken when it was removed from the site. Schweitzer and her colleagues then analyzed the material inside the bones. The vessels and contents are similar in all respects to blood vessels recovered from an ostrich bone. They report in a paper being published Friday in the Scientific Journal. The soft tissues are rare finds. That's why in more than 70 million years old fossil, it is so interesting. They just won't get off of the fact something would deteriorate long before that. See, evolution doesn't fit. Genesis, on page 24 in your booklet, Genesis indicates that the Earth's history is about 6,000 years old, whereas evolutionists claim that it is billions of years old. This T-Rex was 70 million years old. Consider the following statement by Brett Thompson. Now, this is very, very interesting because what he carefully does is reconstruct through biblical genealogies how old, you know, the Earth is, okay? And it may seem a little bit boring, but I'll follow along the best you can. And if you get too bored, well, I'll skip to the end. The truth of the matter is that the Bible, being a book grounded in history, is filled with chronological data that may be used to establish the relative age of the earth. It is not silent on this topic. The Bible, for example, provides exact chronological data from Adam to Solomon, combining information from the Assyrian Epiphany list and the Black Obelisk. I've seen the Black Obelisk. You can see it in the British Museum. The deaths of Ahab have been determined to be about 853 to 852 B.C. And therefore, the reign of Solomon, some 40 years, in Kings, 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 42, can be dated to 971 to 931 B.C. According to 1 Kings 6 and verse 1, 480 years before Solomon's fourth year reign, 976 to 966, Moses brought the Israelites out of Egypt. The date of the Exodus is about 1446 to 1445 B.C. That's when they came out in the Exodus. To this date, add the time of the sojourn in Egypt. They were there 430 years, according to Exodus chapter 12 and verse 40, thereby producing a date of 1876 B.C. as the year Jacob went to Egypt. Interestingly, the Bible records Pharaoh's query of Jacob's age, 130 years, in Genesis chapter 47, verse 9, which would make the year of Jacob's birth 2006 B.C. Abraham was 100 years old when he begat Isaac, giving the date of 2166 B.C. for Abraham's birth. The chronology from Abraham to Adam is recorded very carefully in two separate chronological tables, in Genesis chapter 5 and Genesis chapter 11. According to Genesis chapter 12 and verse 4, Abraham was 75 when he left Haran, presumably after Terah died at 205 years of age. Thus, Abraham was born when Terah was 130 years old, albeit he is mentioned first by importance when Terah began having sons at the age of 70. Having established the birth date of Abraham at 2166, it is possible to work from the time of Adam's creation to Abraham in order to discern the chronology of the beginning. The time from the creation of Adam to Seth was 130 years, according to Genesis 5:3. The time from Adam to Noah was 1,056 years. And the time from Noah's birth to the flood, 600 years, or 1656 after Adam. That's what AA stands for. It appears that Shem was about 100 years old at the time of the flood and begot Arphaxad 2 years after the flood, approximately 1659 after Adam. Arphaxad begat Salah in the 35th year. However, Luke chapter 3, verse 36 complements the chronological table of Genesis chapter 1 with the insertion of Canaan between Arphaxad and Salah, which indicates that likely Arphaxad was the father of Canaan. Proceeding forward, one observes that Terah was born in 1879 after Adam and bore Abraham 130 years later. Simple arithmetic, 2166 added to 2009 after Adam would place the date of creation at approximately 4175 B.C. So you add that to 2011, and what do you have? Very interesting. About a little more than 6,000 years. The Great Flood, then, would have occurred around 2519 B.C. Numerous objections have been leveled at the literal consecutive chronological interpretation of the Scripture. For example, some have suggested that the tables in Genesis 5 and 11 are neither literal nor consecutive. Yet, five of the patriarchs clearly were the literal fathers of their respective sons. Adam, named Seth, Seth named Enos, Lamech named Noah. Noah's sons were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Terah fathered Abraham directly. Jude records, and I think this is so important, Jude records in the New Testament counts that Enoch was, what? The seventh from Adam. So it fits, thereby acknowledging the genealogical tables as literal and consecutive. Moreover, how better could Moses have expressed a literal and consecutive genealogy than by having used the terms, and here's the terms if you read it, lived, begat, begot, after he begat all the days, and he died. See, Moses wrote Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and what? Deuteronomy. Without question, Moses noted that the first three individuals, Adam, Seth, and Enos, were consecutive, and Jude stated by inspiration that the first seventh to Enoch were consecutive. So we know that they were consecutive, one after another, to the seventh generation. Enoch's son, Methuselah, died the year of the flood, and so by three steps, the chronology of Adam to Noah is literal and consecutive, producing a trustworthy genealogy or chronology. There have been those who have objected to the suggestion that God is concerned with providing information on the age of the earth and humanity. But the numerous chronological tables permeating the Bible prove that theirs is a groundless objection. God, it seems, was very concerned about giving man exact chronological data, and in fact was so concerned that he provided a precise knowledge of the period back to Abraham, plus two tables with ages from Abraham to Adam. The ancient Jewish historian in 2 Chronicles 1 through 27, and the New Testament writers, Luke 3, 34 through 48, understood the tables of Genesis 5 and 11 as literal and consecutive. In other words, one year after another year after another year. The Bible explains quite explicitly that God created the sun and the moon to be timekeepers. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 16, for Adam and his descendants. Notice how Noah logged the beginning and the ending of the flood using these timekeepers. Take your Bibles and turn with me to Genesis chapter 7. Genesis chapter 7 and in verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened. How much more specific can you get than that? Now let's look at Genesis chapter 9 and verse 14. Go to Genesis chapter 9. And down in verse 14. And it shall come to pass when I bring the cloud over the earth. I must have the wrong reference in this. God's going to remember the covenant before all flesh. Let me go back and see if I can find it. We'll set a bow in the cloud. Well, I do have a wrong reference in there. But nonetheless, God uses a what? 8:14. All right, back to 8:14. All right. Oh yeah, and in the second month, instead of 9:14, change your notes to 8:14. In the second month, on the 7th and the 20th day of the month, the earth was dried, and God spake to Noah, saying, "Go forth from the ark, thou and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee." And so, while it is true that genealogies and chronologies serve various functions in the Scriptures, one of their main purposes is to show the historical connection of the great men to the unfolding of God, Jehovah's redemptive plan. These lists, therefore, are a link from the earliest days of humanity to the completion of God's salvation system. In order to have any evident value, they must be subsequently complete. Various biblical dating chronologies differ slightly. There's, like I said, the one that's added in the New Testament, a few years here, perhaps 100 years there. But no biblical dating chronology allows for a date of creation older than several thousand years. And so I just very clearly, looking at the chronology, believe that the earth is between 6,000 and 8,000 years old. And when you find stuff like the scientists are finding that the blood in a T-Rex, it couldn't have been 70 million years old. All right, Genesis says man had the ability to use language from the beginning so that he might communicate with God. According to evolution, language evolved from animal grunts and squeals. Yeah. It's important to understand that even modern archaeology says that writing began. Here's what's so interesting. Writing began about 5,000 years ago, which fits the Bible's record exactly. And there you go. Genesis says man had the ability to create an intelligent civilization from the very beginning. It says clearly that Adam's children, they built cities, they raised cattle, they created musical instruments, worked in brass, they worked in iron. Turn with me to Genesis chapter 4. They didn't start out with cavemen dragging their knuckles on the ground going, and then stumble on some language. All right, in Genesis chapter 4, down in verse 17, let's see, Genesis 4:17. Let me get it right. I'm in the wrong chapter, Genesis 4:17. Okay, boy, do I have another one? Okay, there we go. It's 17, yeah, Cain knew his wife, and she conceived, and there we go, bare Enoch, and he builded a city and called the name of the city after his son Enoch. And unto Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat Mahjel, and Mahjel brought Methusel, and Methusel begat Lamech, and Lamech took unto him two wives. The name of one was Ada, the name of the other was Zillah. And Ada bare Jabal, and he was the father, there you go, of all such dwell in tents and such as have cattle. So they domesticated them. And the brother's name was Jabal, and he was the father of all such that handled the harp and the organ. And Zillah, she also bare Tubal-Cain, the instructor in artifice and brass and iron. So early on, they built cities. Early on, they knew how to use musical instruments. Early on, They domesticated animals and reared animals. They worked in brass. They worked in iron. Most people, even most educated, know little about evolution and are not prepared to defend it. So this is back to us. It's kind of on our head. The Bible believer does not need to be intimidated by the evolutionists. Just don't be intimidated by the evolutionists. They are usually very ill-prepared to defend it. High school biological textbooks deal with the subject almost in passing and typically toss out a few of the shop-worn icons such as the embryo and the horse chart, which is all a bunch of bunk, by the way. And on a flight to San Diego to Seattle, David Cloud had a conversation with a PhD candidate in biology, and he, the PhD candidate, admitted that he only knew a few things about Darwinian evolution and learned a little bit about it in the college textbook. Though he believed it, he was unprepared to defend it. See, all scientists, we believe in evolution. Darwin and his followers use a bait-and-switch technique. Bait-and-switch is routinely used. They try to prove evolution of creatures, such as reptiles turning into birds, from evidence of minor changes within species, such as different types of beaks on finches and different coloring of peppered moths, or the change in the eating habits of caterpillars, or the adaption of bacterium. Adaption within species is dramatically different from the changes required for the creation of new creatures. The difference has been referred to as microevolution and macroevolution. I've explained this before, but there is such a thing, and I hate to call it evolution, but there is such a thing as microevolution, change within species. And the evidence I used previously is the change within dogs. You have little dogs and big dogs. I believe God created two dogs, and then through breeding and different things, you have changes within the species. Macroevolution is changing from a dog to a horse or something on that. It just doesn't happen. But you don't see that happen. Darwin pointed to the variety among pigeons to prove that natural selection can produce changes. Yet, there is zero evidence that such modification can change a pigeon into something else, or that such modifications can create a wing or produce flight. This is like comparing apples to oranges. Darwin's book on the origin of species is a masterpiece of bait and switch. He gave no evidence that species could originate through his propositions. James Parloff says, Darwin's On Origin of Species discussed survival of the fittest, but not the arrival of the fittest. The term science must clearly be defined. Now, this is important, so see if you can get this one. It's important to understand that there are two types of science. There is operational or empirical science, and there's observational or historical science. Operational science deals with testing and verifying ideas in the present and leads to the production of useful products like computers, cars, satellites. Historical science involves, here it is, interpreting, and I say the word again, interpreting evidence from the past, and includes the models of evolution and special creation. recognizing that everyone has presuppositions that shape the way they interpret the evidence is an important step to realizing that historical science is not equal to operational science. You need to understand that. Because no one was there to witness the past except God, we must interpret it based on a set of starting assumptions, or if you would, presuppositions. Presuppositions, okay? Scientists have accomplished wonderful things through empirical science, such as building technological devices, exploring the living cell. But when they try to look beyond the physical world and beyond the constraints of time, they enter into a sphere about which they are not qualified to speak. They leave the evidence, and they enter into what? Speculation. For example, this is on February 5th, 2004, in a Japanese nanot bulletin, it featured an article by Professor Namba, and it's talking about a little cell, a flagellum motor. They were examining it. It's very, very minute, but nature created a rotary motor with a diameter of 30 nanometers. Motility of a bacteria such as Salmonella and E. coli with a body size of about 1 or 2 microns is driven by rapidly rotation of a helical propeller by such a tiny little motor at its base. The organella is called a flagellum, made of a rotary motor and a tiny helical filament that grows up to 15 microns and rotates around 2,000 RPMs. And with energy conversion efficiency of close to 100%. Now, the reason I'm giving you that is because there's two things that are going on here. You have historical science and empirical science combined in this article. And if you don't know what the difference is, you can be confused. This paragraph is a mixture of empirical and historical science. The description of the flagellum motor is based upon observational science. But the statement, nature created, how do you know that nature created? You know what? That's based on their presupposition. That's their historical. Nature created this motor is not based on any scientific evidence. It is pure speculation based on an evolutionary assumption. The Japanese Nanot Bulletin is qualified to report on the construction of the biological nanomotors, but it is not qualified to tell us how these motors came into existence. Nature did it. Mother Nature. For that, we must look beyond man's mind. We must look to God and His divine revelation. Evolution is based on unproven assumptions. One of the things that will become evident, and the hope has become evident as we laid this out for you, is that evolution is based on many unproven assumptions. If evolutionists are not allowed to assume their doctrine, they have no evidence. In 1887, John Dawson wisely observed, "Let the reader take up either of Darwin's great books or Spencer's biology, and merely ask himself as he reads each paragraph, what is assumed here and what is proven? What is assumed, what is proven?" And he will find that the whole fabric of evolution melts away like a vision. All right. Now, Pastor Darrell covered some of this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time here, but homology, Dawson was correct, and nothing has changed in regards since that day. Consider some examples. Homology. One of the most used icons of evolution is homology, and what that is it's similarities between creatures' limbs and organs. Darwin made so much of homology that he said that it would cause him to believe in evolution even if there was no other evidence. Basically, he goes on, if you go down to the bottom paragraph on page 30, it says, in reality, the similarity of limbs, such as bone structures of the human arm, the alligator leg, the bird wing, provide zero evidence for evolution. It says, unless one assumes that evolution has occurred. Similarly, similarity of structures is neither evidence for common descent nor evidence against common design. What are you looking for, Desma? All right. Okay. Let's turn the page. We're going to jump over to the bottom of page 32. It says, armed with the knowledge that evolutionists assume their doctrine to be true and conduct their science on the basis, the Bible believer will not be led astray by evolutionary media presentations, whether in print or in museums or on the web or in documentaries. For example, here's one of the biggest examples, the existence of extraterrestrials. Do you know that our government spends several multiplied millions of dollars a year trying to communicate with extraterrestrials? Let me see if I can communicate with them right now. Well, National Geographic documentary, and I've seen a portion of this and was laughing so hard I just turned it off. The Known Universe, number 2, examines the evidence for extraterrestrial life. With its spectacular graphics and interviews with scientists with impressive credentials, it has the air of great scientific authority, but it lacks real substance. Oh, yeah. Let's go to Area 51. In reality, listen to this, it was based upon the evolutionary assumption combined with speculation. Some major assumptions are as follows. Here's what their assumptions are. Here's where they're coming from. Here's why they think that there's extraterrestrials. Earth could not be special. Man could not just be special creation, but life evolved on Earth, therefore life could evolve all elsewhere. They don't believe in creation, so why is Earth so special? With billions of stars out there, surely there's life. That's a mere assumption. They got all excited because they found ice on Mars. Maybe there are Martians. Who knows? Inert molecules can form life if a liquid is present to agitate them. This is what they said. Therefore, life could form elsewhere if liquid water or even liquid methane were present. That's why they were so excited when they found ice crystals on Mars, you know. Molecules must move around and interact to form the chemistry for life. Liquid allows the atoms to mix together to form the building blocks, it should say, to form the building blocks of life. This is mere assumption. In fact, Dr. David Stone says, it's even worse. It's just a word game. No one has ever offered a system of chemical reaction and a proposed scientific model at all. There is no scientific support. As going on, why there must be life on other planets. Since life exists in harsh environments on Earth, this means that life can evolve in harsh environments elsewhere. They said, we have to understand that life will evolve under conditions that are horribly hostile. Well, really? That's a mere assumption. Life on Earth formed by adapting to the environment. Therefore, extraterrestrial life will be adapted to its environment. So we're going back to this program, and these are the things that they're saying. Over hundreds of millions of years, all of life forms on our planet have adapted to their environment. You have to say it, you know, kind of regally, like you're a scientist there. Scientists are quoted as imagining that life on a high gravity planet would be here's what they were saying. Scientists are quoted as imagining life on a high gravity planet would be squat and have many thick legs, whereas life on a low gravity planet would be spindly like spiders. Okay. It's purely assumption. Here's the truth of the matter. Unbelieving scientists are highly motivated not to criticize evolution. That is the intellectual accepted thing, is to be accepting of evolution. This is because Darwinian evolution is the religion of modern science. It is. It is the religion of modern science. And it's not acceptable to question it. Many have lost promotions and jobs and been denied degrees and awards and grants for even questioning evolution, not to speak of rejecting it. In the video documentary, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, Ben Stein examines the persecution of scientists and professors who dared to question Darwinism or to promote even the slightest evidence of intelligence design. In Slaughter of the Dissidents, Jerry Bergman, he is a biology of Columbia Pacific and he has a PhD, tells the shocking truth about killing the careers of Darwin doubters. In the introduction, John Eidsmo says, in this fascinating book, Dr. Jerry Bergman, himself a victim, chronicles the history of modern religious persecution in America. A highly respected, credentialed, and published professor has been denied tenure and subsequently fired, admittedly because his creation, beliefs, and writings. Dr. Bergman describes numerous other cases, often concealing the names to protect those who do not wish to lose their current positions. A common means of persecuting those with the minority views. Dr. Bergman testifies, quote, a factor that moved me to the creationist side was the underhanded, often totally unethical techniques that evolutionists typically use to suppress dissident ideas, primarily creationism. Rarely did they carefully and objectively examine the facts, but usually they focused on suppression of creationism, denial of their degrees, denial of their tenure, and ad hominem attacks, and in general, irrational attacks on their person. In short, their response in general was totally unscientific and one that reeks of intolerance and hatred. See, if you have a degree, that's an earned degree, and you come to the creation position, you see, for a number of years, as the president of Logos Communication Consortium, we had a homeschool division. And it's interesting how many of our graduates who they have kept records and they have taken the test to prove their sufficiency, when they try and work for the government or get a government job, you know what? They say, oh, well, you're going to have to get a GED or something. We can't accept this. You know who characteristically wins the spelling bees nationally? Homeschool kids. Because they're spending less time learning about sex and less time learning about being tolerant of perversions and all that sort of stuff. The government schools, you can like it, you can lump it, whatever you want, but they don't like people who hold the Christian world and life view. Regardless of how educated they might be, Christians, particularly in the scientific community, who hold to biblical creationism. And as you can see in this booklet, there's many, many evolutionists or people, they say that Darwinian evolution doesn't have a leg to stand on, but that doesn't matter to them. You know why? It's a religion. It's a religion. Evolution is a religion. And it goes on. I tell you about this in court. It was testified that evolution is a religion. They accuse us of being religious. Well, I'm not religious. I'm a Christian. I'm a born-again believer. But evolution is as much a religion as anything else because they worship at the altar of Charles Darwin. I hope it's been helpful to you. I know that some of the stuff may have been a little bit boring, but I hope you hang on to Pastor Darrell's notes on these things, because if you take time, there's some good stuff you can teach your kids and your grandkids so they don't have to swallow the lie of evolution. Appreciate you being here. We have the closing program on Sunday evening. If you had children in VBS, they will earn points and can get prizes. But thank you so much for being with us, and thank you for those of you who provided the food. God bless you, and I hope that it helps you to be a little stronger in your Christian faith in the area of creationism. Take care. Good night.